C1P. Number 8A.
We come now to the third part in this chapter, and we have seen that the third part has the overall tone life and soul, in the meaning that being, life, is changeless soul. Now, what does that mean? It means that here the practitioner has to take the attitude that that which is life is always unchangeable, that which is always immortal soul, that which is life is always intact soul, that which is can never get lost, soul never loses anything. That which is life is always untouched soul by any kind of error. So that which is will be eternally preserved in an unchangeable way. So you can see here now, it isn't a question as in the second part that we ask ourselves now, what is the truth that we have to know? And therefore we are establishing in consciousness that we have to know the truth about mind and about spirit and soul and principle, life, truth and love. Now here is a question that when one has established in consciousness the truth that should make us free, that then in the third part we have to see that we have to stick to that vision and not let it go anymore, that we see that this is really the reality of being, life, which is ever unchangeable, soul. So that we also must see that all the arguments that are brought forth against the true facts of being will never touch really the beingness of being, that will never touch the actuality of being, the factuality of being, and therefore can never, so to say, deflect being. So can you keep in mind that overall tone, that which is life remains always intact, no matter what happens, that nothing on earth can really touch it. Nothing on earth really can destroy it or touch it or deflect it. What else can you say in order to take away the identity? It can never really mar it. Nothing can happen anymore to that which is. So, if we look at the seven epitomes, then we see that we have built up really every epitome in that way that we show that the facts of being are always untouched. So, you can see in mind, we just go quickly through the main tones that you have on page 6 and 7, those main tones that are printed in bold letters. You see that the law of being is mind. You have being as mind, namely the law of mind. Always untouched. Untouched by what? By the opposite, really, of mind. Untouched by the belief of mortal mind. Or you take spirit. Spirit is the substance of being. So the substance of being is spirit, and that is always untouched by its opposite of spirit, untouched by matter. She takes in the example of food. Or you come to soul and you begin to realize that soul has to do with the supremacy of soul, the rule of soul, so that the supremacy of soul is really the true being, and that that is untouched by the counterfeit of soul, namely untouched by corporeal conditions, by bodily conditions. Can you see? And when you come to principle, principle is always symbolized through the government of principle. So the government of principle is always at the point of isness, it is, and that remains untouched by the opposite of principle, namely by human theories. Or you go to life and you see that the immortality of being is a self-supporting life, that's life, and that is always untouched by the opposite, untouched by destructive influences. Or you take truth, really the true form of truth, the health of being, the true form of being, or the health of being is the consciousness of truth, and that is always untouched by its opposite, namely by mortal manhood. Or we take love, the fulfillment of being is what? That we see that love is perfect and makes perfect, that's the perfection of love, and that remains always untouched by its counterfeit, namely always untouched by imperfection. Have you heard how these epitomes are built up, that they follow a pattern which embody always the two points, life and soul, namely always being, which is untouched? That term untouched flows right through the seven epitomes. So being is untouched. What is being? Being is, at the point of mind, the law of mind. And so we will see how Mrs. Eddy deals with that subject. So we take the first main epitome, mind, that the law of being is mind. You see, law has always to do with mind, so the lawfulness of being is actually mind, because mind is the law, and that lawfulness of being in mind is always untouched, so by the opposite of the law, by the beliefs of mortal mind. I think these epitomes are rather clear in showing really the blending of those tones. See, naturally you have to become aware that when we consider these epitomes that you have always at least three tones in it, namely the overall tone, life and soul, then the main tone of mind, and then usually the subtones, so that you really hear a melody with four voices, with four instruments being played. Naturally, your ear has to get accustomed to keep these instruments, these four instruments that are playing here the melody, to keep them apart. It isn't anymore so that you can read the text just linearly, as if it would just be one linear line of reasoning, as if you would hum a melody, then you only have a one-voice melody, and you flow along a linear way just with one voice. Here you have already a little band playing that melody with four different instruments, and every instrument plays another tone, but together they make the melody. So reading the textbook means that you read the text like a score and not just as a linear development of a single tone. All right. So we have here that main tone, that the law of being is mind, Therefore, that what goes on in being is a law of divine mind. And that what's going on in being, therefore, is never a belief of mortal mind. So whatever people think, whatever their opinions are, whatever they voice, whatever their conceptions are, that never touches that which goes on in being, in the law of being. This is a very great point to consider in practice here. And I think she introduces that third part with a very simple illustration. I always feel if one keeps that little illustration in mind, one more or less has caught the tone of the whole third part. You know, it's that where she says, a blundering dispatch. You see, it's a blundering. It says no more its true identity. The blundering dispatch mistakenly announcing the death of a friend occasions the same grief that the friend's real death would bring. Says, can you see there is no difference if your friend has actually died and you grieve about it, then you grieve because he has died, but you have the same grief if somebody mistakenly tells you, you know, your friend has died. So you grieve also, but he's happily alive. So in this way, she wants to bring home two things. First of all, that it is the belief in death that gives us grief, not the death itself. And then she goes on and will show that in either case, this is not an occasion for grief, because being never dies. So you think that your anguish is occasioned by your loss. Loss is so. Can being be touched and be lost? And you think, yes, it can. Another dispatcher correcting the mistake heals your grief. And you learn that your suffering was merely the result of your belief. So again, we can see that she wants to bring out all those negative experiences, all the discord is actually only a belief, and we are grieving over something just because of a belief. Thus it is with all sorrow, sickness, and death. She says, now this is only an example, but it is the same way with all sorrow, sickness, and death. You will learn at length that there is no cause for grief. Now she brings it up to the metaphysical point and says, actually there is no cause of grief, and divine wisdom will then be understood. Error, not truth, produces all the suffering on earth. Because then she goes on naturally and says, if a Christian Scientist had said, while you were laboring under the influence of the belief of grief, your sorrow is without cause, you would not have understood him. You would have said, don't be silly, my friend has died. I'm grieving about it. So he would have said they would not have understood him, although the correctness of the assertion might afterwards be proof to you. So, when our friends pass from our sight, now you see she brings it now to what is called really dying. So when our friends pass from our sight and we lament, that lamentation is needless and causeless, has no cause. Why? You say, but he has died now. This time it was not a blundering dispatch, a mistaken dispatch. Therefore, he really died, and I saw him die. I saw him how they put him into a coffin and afterwards buried him. We shall perceive this to be true when we grow into the understanding of life and know that there is no death, that death is just as much a blundering dispatch, just as much a belief as a false dispatch. So here we get, so to say, the basis of everything. I think if one understands that symbolism, that illustration, clear enough in its fundamental issue, then I think one can understand the whole third part, because the third part is only showing variations through the seven synonymous term of how we believe that being can be changed, whereas being, life, remains always unchanged, soul, always untouched by everything that's going on in the realm of unreality. That no counterfeit sense of being can really touch reality, and that reality remains what reality is, and there is nothing to be changed about that. Yes. So here, Mrs. Eddy has presented first that law of mind, that in the law of mind, that's our epitome on the mindless mind, that in the law of mind there exists no cause for any loss. Yeah? Do we believe it? Do we believe that in the law of mind there is no cause for any loss? Can you hear loss is it's a counterfeit of soul? Huh? So there is no cause in mind that can cause a loss. Mind is soul. Mind is always complete, intact, has always its perfect identity, is unchangeable, untouched by anything. Therefore, even at this point, we really could see, then I could really go through all the seven synonymous terms and all the subtones and just see that everything that is unlike really the nature of God, the seven synonymous terms, can never really be lost. That would mean that we can never lose the substance of spirit, that we can never lose the sinlessness and incorporeality of soul, that we can never lose the government of principle, that we can never lose the eternality of life, that we can never lose the health of truth, that we can never lose the perfection of love. It's just not possible. So I have talked a bit at length about this first illustration, because I feel it's really telling us the fundamental story. It gives us that consciousness, to repeat it again, it gives us that consciousness that when we have established in the second part, truth and mind, if we have established there the truth that we can know, the truth about all the seven synonymous terms that we can know, that then, when we have established that we can say, now what I have established in consciousness, that's now being. That's now the isness of being. This is what exists. This is the factual existence of being. And therefore we take the attitude, and nothing can touch that anymore. No argument, no suggestion, nothing can touch that anymore. And we stick with that. So it gives a great sense of that sense of being perseverant in what we have seen in the second part. And that perseverance in what we have seen in the second part is really the method, here the third part, of the practitioner. If we go on and consider this law with a subtone of spirit, the epitome reads, the ever-active mind, we are still in mind, does not wear out. Can you see, does not wear out means soul. Cannot wear out, we cannot lose it, does not fade away. Soul is always intact. And so it does not wear out what? Its spiritual energies. Here you have the subtone of spirit. That the activity of mind are spiritual energies and that they can never get lost. She says that, on the contrary, that if we remain in the activity of mind, that it makes us grow stronger, the strength of spirit. How is the reasoning here? She again compares really the argument, the suggestion of mortal mind, and then afterwards the facts about mind. See, if you read the textbook, you always must read the textbook, not sentence by sentence. That doesn't really give us a great insight. You must see, for instance, how she always contrasts opposites, that she makes statements for perhaps a few lines about the negative standpoint and then corrects it from the positive standpoint, so that at once you always get the sense of putting an argument against the truth and weighing these arguments against the truth. So here she first speaks again about the argument of mortal mind, which says, if your mind is active, the belief is that you will suffer of softened brain, that it wears out your brain, that matter will suffer under it, that intellectual labor brings you to the limits of mental endurance, that you lose your strength and your energies. That's the belief, that using mortal mind and intellectual mind, that can wear you out. So that thinkers die early. Here you have the tone of life. So that finally they die. Showing again what? That mortal mind has the argument that it can touch being, and therefore destroy being. So Mrs. Eddy has to show, no, you can't do that. Then she gives then the positive answer to it, the isness sense of it, and says, well, mind cannot be overworked, because mind is ever active. So that spiritual energies, the true spiritual energy, here you have mind, the spirit, the spiritual energies cannot wear out. They cannot get lost. So they stay what they are. They remain what they are. You see, always when you have a sense, they remain what they are. They remain intact. You have a great sense of soul. And so we cannot suffer from it. Quite to the contrary, we grow stronger because of it. So here you have a second incidence of the law of mind, which says that law of mind has within itself the energies of spirit, and that remains completely untouched by the activities of mortal mind, the counterfeit of mind, which say that you wear out, that you lose your energies, spirit. She goes further to mind as soul. The epitome reads, omnipotent mind defends man from bodily suffering. Can you hear the tone of mind as soul, which says, if you are in the one mind, then there is nothing that is nothing of the opposite sense of soul can happen. The opposite of soul is suffering, sensation. Then you will never really suffer. So you are free from bodily suffering. And she says, look at the Christian martyrs. They proved that. The Christian martyrs, they have won a victory over corporeal sins. Namely, dire inflictions failed to destroy them. Couldn't destroy them. Why? Because they were relying on the law of mind, which is soul. Namely, mind, their heavenly father, has a supporting influence. Can you hear? Mind's influence. A protecting power, the power of mind. And that power, she says, defends him from bodily suffering. So you see how she appeals here, really, to the law of mind, What does she really say now if we just go through those three subtones? That she would show that as our law of being is what? Mind, the divine mind. That's our law of being. That law of being can never be changed. Because we rest on that law of being, then really our whole being life is free from, is untouched by. So, by what? As a subtone of mind, it's free from a cause of loss. In that law of mind, there is never a cause that can take away something from us, that can cause a loss of any kind. In that one being, that law of mind, there are the energies of spirit, and they always have the energies of spirit. They never wear out. They always remain intact. They never wear out. Whereas the belief is that really the activities of the brain and of the muscles and so on wear us out. Or you take the subtone of soul and says, if we remain in that law of mind, which is absolutely untouched by mortal mind and by mortal beliefs, then you are free from bodily sufferings, because mind will control it and support it. So like martyrs, we can really win a victory over corporeal sense. Yes. So the martyrs really gave an example of seeing that being cannot be destroyed, and that they knew that being could not be destroyed, therefore they were also willing to be crucified, to put before the lions and so on, because they knew that the law of mind cannot be touched, that law of mind is eternal life, and that eternal life can never be destroyed. So they were full of that spirit, which they would see. See, they saw that, and that is the only thing that made any impression on the Romans, that these Christians were not weeping and howling because the lions were eating them up. They were singing, and they were singing hymns and so on. They were rejoicing in the fact that life is a law of mind, and that law of life can never be touched by anything, not even by lions. Yes, so this is mind. I think it's a very clear example of how a practitioner really has to stick to his vision, has stick to his knowledge of truth, so that he doesn't yield to suggestions of mortal, from the side of mortal mind. Because mortal mind will always come up and bring forth some suggestion and say, it's not going good, it's not really going well. And so we have to stick to that fact that is real in being, and not in human testimony, real in being, that being is a law of mind. Yes.